Let's go.
Ready.
Ready. So ready.
You're so calm. You're like calmer than me by a million miles right now.
Oh, really?
I feel like it probably is a testament to the work that you do, possibly. I get that energy from you a little bit.
I've done a lot of meditation today. I've done a lot of breathing.
You are glowing.
Breathing techniques today, so it might be that thing.
Yeah, I have been in the office all day sniffling away and in a lot of workshops with clients. So very different energies, but I think we're just going to...
We'll match each other. We'll mirror. It'll like all smooth itself out. It always does.
Sounds good. So I'm going to completely throw you under the bus, Angie.
Okay.
Should we do like a quick 2 minute breathing?
Yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. Okay. What kind of zone do you want to get in?
I think grounded and calm, but focused.
Okay, so we'll uncross our legs.
Okay.
Sit up. Hands can be on your lap or your thighs or your knees.
Okay.
And turn the palms to face up. Close the eyes. Breathing in through your nose. Out through your nose. Breathing in through the count, breathing in for the count of two through your nose. And out for the count of four. Inhale for two. Exhale for four. Inhale for two. Exhale for four. Inhale for two. Exhale through your mouth. Inhale for two. Exhale, mouth. Inhale two. Big sigh out. And then release. Come to breathing in and out through your nose. Take a few rolls in your shoulders. In the other direction. Come back to center. Both hands on your heart. And blink the eyes open. The space. Grounded?
I think I'm going to fall asleep now.
You won't. You'll be more focused now. You'll be more productive and focused now. That's often the way.
I'm so glad.
After a breathing technique or a meditation, we often do feel like we're going to fall asleep or really, in that dozy state because we've got into the parasympathetic nervous system, which is basically known as the rest and digest state.
Mm-hmm.
So scientifically, we've taken ourselves out of the high levels of cortisol, which is our stress hormone, and adrenaline and that kind of go.
Yeah.
And we've released hormones like oxytocin, that love hormone, that calming down, feeling more grounded, lowered our blood pressure, lowered our heart rate because we've changed our breathing in order to do those things.
Mm.
So it's almost like a quick fire way to tell yourself, I'm safe.
Mm.
And then when we're safe, we can fall asleep.
Yes.
You know, so that's why. But actually, you also improve your focus, improve your memory. There's a whole host of things. So you won't fall asleep, don't worry. I hope not.
Good. That's good. No, I'm sure I won't. Well, thank you so much. And actually, it's interesting. I did read something recently that when you're with people that you feel comfortable with, you fall asleep.
Mm.
And I find often when I talk to my parents at the end of the day, it's kind of like a daily thing that we try and do. I'm yawning and falling asleep and they get offended. They're like, are you bored of us? And I'm like, I think I'm just comfortable. So it's very interesting you said that because I literally read that like a couple of days ago.
That's nice.
Angie, welcome to Brown Game Strong.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It's such a pleasure to have you on. And I was saying to you when you walked in, I mean, I know this is the first time we've met in person. It doesn't feel like it for me. We connected, I think, during lockdown time, and I remember we collaborated on the Small Business Sunday series that we were doing, and you were kind enough to share, you know, everything about the work that you do. And I think at the time we were both still figuring things out. And it's just amazing to see how far you've come in your journey in the last 2-3 years that I've known you. And I'm just really excited that we can be here in person and, you know, have a chat. And I have lots and lots that I want to know about your journey, your experience, the work that you do, but also in the wider context of the community that we're in, because it's something that I, as someone who takes, you know, yoga classes and reads about meditation, tries to do some meditation at home, as someone who is desi, living in the West, being taught by people who are not desi, I have very recently been questioning, you know, what am I actually doing? Like, should I be learning from people who, you know, are like, you know, very much pertain to those roots that that things like yoga come from. So yeah, just looking forward to this chat, and I'm sure you have lots and lots to share around these topics. So I want to start off by just asking you, tell us, Angie, about yourself, what you do, what is your sort of mission at the moment that you're trying to put out into the world, and how are you trying to help others and serve others?
Yeah, so big question. But the vision for me is, you know, my question to get to what the vision and the mission is why do I exist as a yoga teacher?
Yeah.
Because there are so many people who teach yoga, meditation, breath, and what do I want to bring to it? Mm-hmm. And it's really about changing the industry. I do not want it to continue to be a toxic industry where so many people come to those practices that are all about uniting individually as a community, getting to this higher state of consciousness, finding peace, finding acceptance. So many people feel the opposite. Mm. And they feel excluded. They feel like it's very cliquey, myself included. I've felt that cliqueiness. They feel they have to have really expensive activewear in order to do yoga, the most expensive mats. They feel that it's not for you if you're plus sized, you're in a bigger body, or if you are a particular race or a particular gender, or there's so many things within the industry and generally within the well-being space that make people feel like they can't be part of it.
Yeah.
And for me, I really want people to know that they can be. Mm. And that's really what it comes down to. It's about unearthing the ancient rituals that are so sacred that you don't often see in westernized yoga classes and bringing those to the forefront, but also unearthing the things within you that often you feel like you can't do because you can't get to that level of vulnerability that perhaps you'd want to get to in a practice, because there's so much comparison and judgment and all these kind of things because of the way that yoga has been represented to us in quite a toxic way. Mm. So really about changing that. And to your point around our community, I want to change this for our community. I don't want my future children to feel, and they'll be half Indian, but to feel like yoga is not a practice that comes from their culture and feel like it's not something that they can partake in. Mm. So again, about really elevating other South Asian yoga teachers, elevating these wellness practices so that people feel intuitive, that they can trust their intuition, and they feel included in the practice.
That's such a noble mission, and I can see that you're doing it. I've not been to one of your classes yet or one of your retreats.
You need to come.
I want to. I really do. Before we start kind of with just going back a notch and talking about where you started in your journey, I want to ask you, do you really believe there is space for everyone doing this work in the yoga world in the West? Or do you think sometimes people might gatekeep it a little bit?
Mm, I think, you know, you said earlier around you're questioning whether you should learn from only desi people, only people from South Asia who are teaching yoga. And I don't think you should. Mm. I really don't. And I think that's maybe that's a personal view. But the reality is, it's you pay money and you go and you do your yoga teacher training and you come back and you're a yoga teacher. Mm. And it's so, there's obviously financial restrictions there, but it's so open to so many people.
Yeah.
And I also don't think that necessarily South Asian yoga teachers are the best yoga teachers. I think there's a difference between honoring the culture in the way that we teach. Mm. Because also, if we say that South Asian yoga teachers are the best yoga teachers, we're also putting this stereotype of all brown South Asian people know their culture in and out and were raised with it.
Yeah.
Whereas the reality is, I was raised with the practice of yoga, but then there were loads of things within it that I didn't realize. So then when I got the westernized view of yoga, I was appropriating. Mm.
Okay.
I was saying, I didn't know about the context of what happened when British ruled India and they made yoga illegal. I didn't know that. That was a discovery I made in my late 20s. So I think we can't expect all South Asian people to know everything about yoga and to practice everything about yoga.
Yeah.
If there's so I kind of see it from that lens. Like if I didn't know some things, then I can't expect everyone to know these things. And really, I think it's about there's so many yoga teachers, regardless of what you look like or what your heritage is. And how do we get more people to teach respectfully? So that you can go to a white yoga teacher as much as you can go to a brown yoga teacher, as much as you can go to a black yoga teacher. Mm. And they're all teaching with respect. Respect being they're pronouncing these ancient Sanskrit words correctly. They're making an effort to explain what those words are. So you haven't got a group full of students just chanting Om for no reason and not knowing what the hell they're saying or why they're saying it or the significance of that sacred word. So, and there's so many ways that we can teach respectfully to the culture, but also inclusively to whoever we've got in our class.
Mm.
That might be a controversial view. And I know there are some South Asian teachers who will say you should only practice with a South Asian yoga teacher. I personally disagree. I do think that we should elevate South Asian yoga teachers more so that it's less of a whitewashed industry. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't think the solution to the problem is eliminate white yoga teachers, because I think that's just further exclusion, further discrimination, and doesn't lend itself to really what yoga is all about.
Mm. I have so many follow-up questions. The first one being, you see variations of yoga these days, right? You've got puppy yoga, goat yoga. I think there's hip-hop yoga nowadays.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on all of these kind of variations and gimmicks?
I think they create a narrative that yoga isn't enough as it is. And ultimately, when you add the word puppy on, and I love puppies, they're very cute.
I really want to go to puppy yoga.
Yeah.
Am I appropriating?
I think puppy yoga is, so all of these like puppy yoga, goat yoga, when you add something to the word yoga that hasn't got anything to do with it, and again, that's up to interpretation, right? Because you could say like, oh no, you're cuddling puppies and cuddling is love and love is yoga unity. You know, this is the issue, is that it's so open to interpretation, the practice of yoga, and there's so many different routes you can go down. However, with those practices, they're gimmicky. And they're commercialized and they're there to get you to pay to come.
Yeah.
And I actually got asked to do puppy yoga the other day to teach, which I did really question whether the person had done their research on the kind of stuff that I talk about. But I got the schedule so they sent me an email, and they also sent over, this is what we would need from you. And it's 45 minutes of playing with puppies, 15 minutes of yoga, and then half an hour back with the puppies.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, it's basically play with puppies. And then the puppies are just left to run free on your yoga mats. And it's very cute, but it detracts from the real meaning of what yoga is.
Mm.
And that's why it's problematic. And that's why it's considered to be an appropriated form of the practice. Are you the devil if you do puppy yoga? No, but it's just understanding the context and understanding that gives you more of an awareness to then make an informed decision as to whether you wish to move ahead with that or whether you wish to go and just play with a load of puppies.
Are you the devil if you teach puppy yoga?
I don't think anyone's the devil. I think a lot of people are uneducated. Myself, I would include myself in that. I'm still continually learning. And a lot of us are uneducated on what yoga really is.
Yeah.
Because we see yoga as basically the same as Pilates, which is physical movements.
Yeah.
We don't see it for the deeper spiritual practice that it is. So it feels harmless to add puppies and goats and whatever animals we love to the practice. Of course it does, because we don't know the context. So when you do the education and you start to unlearn all of this stuff and all these narratives that have been taught to us about what yoga is, you then start to unpick and then start to look at the world very differently.
Yeah.
And it's really hard, because obviously there's, before all these realizations, my view of yoga was really innocent.
Yeah.
And it's challenging now to know what I know and to not, and to not feel there's an issue here, you know?
What's the biggest thing you've learnt that has kind of blown your mind about the reality of yoga in the commercial space?
I think just looking at it, like understanding what the practice is really about, which is it's a deep spiritual practice to connect deeper within you. It's about connecting to the supreme consciousness within you. It's about unity. The Sanskrit word is yuj, which means to unite or to yoke. And then when you look at the way it's presented, you don't get any of that. I think it's starting to change with people who are pushing this on social media and creating, showing that yoga is about social justice and encouraging that change. But then you see all of that work is done by people of color or the people from those communities.
Mm.
And that's frustrating as well. So I don't know, there's one thing that's kind of blown my mind. I think it's just more looking at the industry and having the realization of, oh, okay, this is actually so different
yeah.
to what it is supposed to be. And that's not to say that it shouldn't evolve, because yoga is evolving and yoga, there's a lot that's open to interpretation. But then you can do that in a respectful way, and in a way that really honors the people who come from that culture.
Mm. That just got me thinking of certain brands, and I think, you know, Lululemon, Aloe included, where you see them on social media, and yes, you are seeing bodies of all shapes and sizes, all colors nowadays as well. And I'm just wondering, is that tokenization?
Mm. I think it depends on so much about these campaigns and the way that brands run campaigns.
Yeah.
So if you've only got people of color, of different sizes, of if you only got people from marginalized minority communities at the forefront of the campaigns, but no one behind the scenes are from those backgrounds, then I think that's quite tokenistic. It is also, so yeah, I agree. A lot of these brands will use people in bigger bodies, people from different cultures. But I don't see these brands using yoga teachers from South Asian culture at all, ever. I've not seen any of them do it.
Wow.
And I honestly think it's because, you know, it's so sad that everything that happened in 2020 with George Floyd created such a shift. And that's good that it created a shift, but it created a shift that meant that so many brands realized that in order to not be called out, they had to bring Black people to feature in their campaigns or behind the scenes or whatever it is. And that's great that that movement happened. But I think because so many people are unaware of the roots of yoga and the importance of the culture, and something big in the world that's awful hasn't happened, it's easier for brands to not put the front foot forward and be innovative and take the initiative to make a change with that. And they're missing a trick, because there are so many theses that would absolutely love to see a South Asian yoga teacher feature on a massive campaign for Lululemon, for example.
Yeah.
And they, all these brands, you could be the first one to do it and you would get a huge kudos for that. And then also empower and encourage other brands to do the same. Mm. But I feel like with a lot of these things, we're almost waiting for something awful to happen in order for for change to come. Which I don't want it, and I don't want it to be that way, which is why I'm trying to do what I'm doing.
Do you think it's also reactive because they're meeting demand? Because when everything happened in 2020 around George Floyd, people were having that conversation. It was at the forefront of their minds. And so suddenly brands saw that as an opportunity to make some bucks.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's something that definitely needs to change. Not just in yoga, just everywhere, right? We're not seeing that yet. In fact, we're seeing it get worse in a way, because it's almost just like nowadays we know that D&I, diversity and inclusion, are topics that are trending and cool. And even running podcasts such as this one is suddenly considered like, oh yeah, it's topical. You know, it's what everyone's talking about. But actually, like, I think we all do need to take a bit of a step back, right? And think, yeah, but longer term, what does this mean for our community? And are we actually doing more harm than good by putting the wrong kind of representation forward? And not because the actual, what you're seeing on screen is bad, it's great. But what's the intention behind that? And is that going to continue? Or tomorrow, if, you know, if there's a different community that is suddenly being talked about, are you going to see more people within that community on the forefront? So I hear a lot, actually, I know I'm digressing a little bit, but I do hear a lot that, you know, it's our time. Like brown girls, like South Asian community, we're all out there doing stuff. It's amazing. We really are. But is there an expiry date to that?
I really hope not, because it's the most empowering thing to see and be a part of and feel. I grew into feeling proud of my heritage and my culture. It's not that the movement that we're seeing, especially in the UK, in London, created that for me, but it's been a real beauty to watch and then be a part of that and just feel even more proud of these incredible, because the thing is, we're, a lot of us are the first or the second generation. So a lot of us have parents who moved over, and my parents moved over to the UK in their 30s and 40s and had my sister and I here. Mm. And so my sister and I have been raised in a very different way to all my cousins who are in India, for example.
Yes, same.
And then there's different opportunities there. And then there's the whole, you're British and you're Indian, and the dichotomy of that, and kind of resonating with how much you feel of each and which one you need to fit in with more, and all of that kind of stuff that's just so different to what my parents experienced. And so you've got a whole group of people who are in that same boat who have the ability to kind of push what we want to do more, and then have the tools like through social media and that kind of thing to push us forward. And we've created this amazing community, and it's so cool to be a part of. So I really, really hope it does not have an expiry date, because I'm loving seeing other South Asians thriving. It's really incredible. I hope it continues. I don't think we are even actually there yet. I think it's just begun.
It's just begun.
But that's my optimistic mindset. But I really do think that.
I hope it's a realistic mindset, because I do think there's so much space and room, and so many voices and stories have not been told. And that's why we do the work we do, isn't it? Because we are those first people that have had the brain space to not be in survival mode.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Right. And one thing as well, you know, I look back at my granddad, my mum's dad, he walked in the Salt March with Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, back in India, before he had my mum, before he was married. And at one point he went into hiding. And this was a peaceful protest against the British going against the salt tax. And a lot is said that Mahatma Gandhi's way that he approached going against the British rule was rooted in yoga, and rooted in the yogic philosophy of ahimsa, which is the first of the yamas. The yamas are these morals that we abide by. And ahimsa means non-violence, non-harm, you know, a peaceful way to be an activist, essentially.
Yeah.
And so fast forward to today, I cannot sit here and exist as a British Indian and watch yoga can still be taken away from my community. I have to be at the forefront of leading the change as a brown yoga teacher, like for him and for my ancestors. You know, that's so important to me. These practices that I was raised with, these practices my grandma taught me, like always raised with chanting and movement and meditation and breathing techniques and kriyas and all this kind of stuff. Like, I have to not only show that to the world, that there's more than just the posture, and here are all the other things that you can be a part of if you're not able-bodied, if you don't want to move today, if you're injured, but show the beauty of that ritual that we miss, that brings so many healing benefits. We just forget about, you know, chanting's incredible. There's so much science that proves that as well. And trying to bring those to the forefront. And there's a whole history as to why it's so important to me, and it's my family always. And in every podcast I do and every article I write, and everyone I speak to, you will hear me talk about my family, because there's such a link between them and why I'm and what my mission is in the yoga industry.
Let's talk about your family then, and your upbringing. So normally I start with that, but I feel like our conversation has just flown. So tell me about your upbringing, what your cultural background is, what your relationship was like with your roots when you were growing up.
Yeah. So my parents moved over to the UK when they were in their 30s and early 40s. And my sister and I here. And I was raised in a household where there was lots of Hindi always being spoken. And we only ate Indian food.
What did you eat?
We just ate like rajma chawal.
I love rajma.
Dosas and idlis. And my family from North India, but we love South Indian food.
Yep, same. I don't get that.
No, I know. It's so good though.
It is really good.
lots of sabzi, lots of aloo, like just, you know, cheesy parathas, everything just delicious. Puris on my birthday. And I went to a school that was quite multicultural.
Yeah.
So I didn't grow up as the only brown kid around loads of white kids at all. But I remember there was some festival on, and we had done puja at home. We'd done prayer at home before we left the house to go to school. And my sister and I still had orange, like the tikka, which is like orangey red on our foreheads. And someone at the bus stop said to us, is that something weird in Indian, or is it orange paint? And my sister just said, it's orange paint.
No, she panicked.
Really quickly. Which is hilarious because, you know, like 7:30 a.m. in the morning, what are we doing with orange paint? Surely it's less weird to have something linked to our culture. But so, you know, that kind of thing where you know that you're there are certain things that you do that the rest of the people that you're in school don't do, I think. And yeah, we my mum used to make us wear neem sticks in our ears, so we weren't allowed to wear earrings at school. So my mum would literally put like neem sticks, which is antibacterial properties of neem,
yeah,
you know, Ayurvedic, and put it through to keep the ear piercing hole open,
okay,
and to not allow it to get infected. And so, you know, I had kids walking around being like, why have you got sticks in your ears? I mean, cheers, mum. But I think also we all had the whole, you know, you go into school and your hair would be look really greasy, but it would have been oiled. And obviously now hair oiling is such a popular thing to do. So there's loads of those things where you'd get called out for it. I wouldn't say I was badly bullied for any of it, but you kind of start figuring out like, oh, okay, maybe things are slightly different.
You're code switching.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what it really was, which I wasn't able to put into words, was this dichotomy and identity switching between you're British and I have a British, strong British accent.
You do.
Versus I'm Indian and at home, my culture is so important. And I was born in a very religious Hindu household. But interestingly, they sent me to like a Christian Catholic school. So it wasn't so religious that it was only Hinduism. But I think Hinduism is quite freeing anyway, right? So that I had both religions, did the Lord's Prayer and everything, but then at home was chanting Om Jai Jagadish Hare, you know, the mixture of the two, which was really beautiful for me.
Wow.
And something I'm really, really grateful for, to singing the hymns about, you know, shine, Jesus, shine, to then doing the chants. I love them both. Essentially, they're both ways to sing and to chant to a divine, to a higher being, to a higher source.
Yes.
My mum taught me yoga when I was growing up. So my parents, obviously, I was around chanting. We call that bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. But my mum used to teach me kriyas, Nauli Kriya, which is the stomach churning one, and also Padmasana, lotus pose, and certain postures she would teach us, which my sister and I loved. We found it so fun.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it.
How did your mum know about it?
She's been practicing yoga when she was in India. Every day she'd wake up at 5 a.m. and do yoga. And then when she moved to the UK, she actually stopped. But she's in her 60s now. And since the pandemic, she practices every single day. She's a member on my membership platform, but before that she would go on my YouTube and she'd always do a class. So she's properly back into it, which is amazing to see, because you can get into it at any age.
Yeah.
But that was my upbringing, a bit of a hybrid between the two identities that you are, I think, when you're born and brought up in this country and you've got parents who have emigrated over.
Where in India did your parents emigrate from?
So Delhi, but my dad's family come from Nainital and my mum's family come from Mussoorie, so north hill stations of India.
And do you visit often?
We've never been up there, actually, but every time we go, all of our family are in Delhi and Gurgaon around that area. So we, when I was growing up, we'd go to India every few years. And I actually think that's something that was so grounding, because I went to a good school and I had a very privileged life in the UK. But when we go back to India, you would see so much poverty and you would see things on the streets that as a child is really quite, I mean, even as an adult, it's quite confronting and quite shocking to see, but also brings you straight back down to earth. And I know that was the country that I'm from, and I have such fond memories of going to India. I always felt very emotional going to India and leaving India. I've not been in such a long time. I'm actually going in a couple of months, which I'm really excited about. Yeah, I always felt drawn to India.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a very different experience, actually, because I think what I didn't like about India growing up was the fact that you just had to cover up and, you know, you wouldn't really be able to walk around by yourself or run around. You had to be kind of chauffeured everywhere. And it's only now in my late 20s that I've experienced going to India and actually taking it in for what it truly is and kind of learning almost like removing those preconceptions I had when I was growing up. So I used to always hate going to India.
Yeah.
And now it's just like, I literally cried. I was there 4 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
And when I came back, I wasn't able to process the fact that I had left. So yeah, it's really interesting how we kind of have our own individual little journeys with going back to the homeland. But I think the one thing that's always stood out to me is I've never felt like I've belonged there, and I've never felt like I fully belong here or anywhere. And, it's one of those things that kind of is beautiful and also sad at the same time. Like, whenever you go back, or when you go back now, like, how do you think that's going to pan out for you? Because obviously you're also, you know, so well versed in sort of ancient Indian rituals. That is literally your career at the moment. So do you feel like you would belong?
No.
Or would you feel like a kind of outsider?
I've never felt like I would ever, there's no part of me that wants to move to India and live in India.
Yeah.
I would go for months at a time and that kind of thing in the future perhaps, but not, I can't see myself uprooting my life and living there. I feel very British in that sense. Yeah. And I feel very, very at home and comfortable in the UK.
Mm.
Even though I feel such an affinity with India and I can't wait to go back and crave going back. I did my yoga teacher training there. So that's another reason why I feel so close. I hold it very close to my heart for that as well. For everything that it brought me at that really troublesome time.
Yeah.
A real savior moment for me was doing that training. And then I went back about 4.5 years ago to do more yoga, but in a different part of India.
Mm.
But I feel very, very excited to go back. I feel very emotional about going back. There's lots of members of the family who have sadly passed away in the last 4.5 years. My husband has never been to India.
Mm.
He's not Indian. He is really excited and I just cannot wait to bring him there. He's met all my family at the wedding. So they came over for the wedding last summer, but I can't wait to take him there. And I think that will be even more, add another layer of emotion to it.
Yeah.
It's emotional anyway when I go to India. I'm a wreck. I honestly just cry. I cry when I land at the airport and there's that brown carpet. And I'm like, I don't know what it's going to be like taking him there.
Oh my gosh, that like, you know, that waft that the just wave, hits
the
you.
Loo. They call it the loo.
The loo.
The hot air.
Yeah.
Especially if it's hot.
Hot air and the smell, like it's like the carpet smell.
The carpet, the brown and then, carpet and is everything for me.
There's this, this is one of the reasons I used to hate going to India was because there was this thing called phenyl, which they would use to clean the toilets. It's this really strong, like toilety kind of smell.
Okay.
And in Delhi airport, which is where we'd always land, you just get this massive waft of that smell. And I'd just be like, I hate this. And then you'd go to like the toilets in, you know, the middle of the dhabas, like on the way to wherever. So my family's from Jaipur, so we'd drive 8 hours.
Okay.
And in there you'd see like just a little lizard just
and the cockroaches. I know. It's just I'm so grateful that my parents took us regularly in my childhood, because without that I would not have any closeness to it. And I think would I have ever gone and done my teacher training in yoga, like would I have gone down the path that I'm in now without that history and the connection? I don't know.
Do you recommend always getting, for anybody who wants to get their yoga teacher training, to get it done in India? Or does it matter?
It's not financially accessible for everyone.
Yeah.
And you're not necessarily always going to learn from South Asian teachers if that's what you want to go to India to do. You need to look into the school that you're going to. You should look into the course of what's being taught. And you should look into the teachers that are teaching that course. Because if you go somewhere like Goa, you'll have a lot of white yoga teachers. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but don't get it in your head that if you go to India, you're going to be learning from people who are brown. And if that's an issue for you, then, you know, do your research. So no, I don't think it's the only way. However, what I would say is, in my experience, all the trainings that I've done in the UK have been frustrating and triggering in the sense that there's been constant mispronunciation of words, conversations which I have found really offensive towards people of my community. It's very difficult then being in a training and feeling safe and open to be able to call that out, because you're the one that's supposed to be learning and in student mode and you don't want to offend the teacher. But I'll always call it out and kind of explain why in an email afterwards or something like that. Because I think actually when you're calling people out, you're calling them in to learn, to grow. It's not about, for me, it's about educating people so we can unlearn and then relearn, not blaming people and making people feel shamed for mistakes that they're only making because of the way the industry is, like the systemic issues create what yoga looks like, and then you're making mistakes off the back of that. So let's not shame people or blame people, but let's create an open space for learning. So I would say that in the UK it's not people DM me all the time asking me where to go for a training, and also ask me to start a teacher training, which I don't think I'm going to do. And I have nowhere to recommend people, because I wouldn't recommend anywhere that I've trained in the UK. Not that I had a bad experience, but I feel like if I'm going to recommend somewhere, I can't recommend somewhere that I know is not in line with my values and views. It's challenging.
You touched on making mistakes. What mistakes have you made in this journey as a yoga teacher and breath work and meditation teacher also?
Yeah. So when I first started, even when I was just practicing yoga, I would say namaste all the time without really thinking about why I was saying it or what it meant in the context of yoga practice. I I'm so glad to say that I am out of this now.
Did you say namaste or namaste?
I always said it properly. I will give myself that, but not thinking. Because you exist in yoga studios and gyms and you learn yoga that way, and it's so different to what you have when you're growing up. So then I'm so glad that I don't do this anymore. But what I would do when I first qualified is want to mirror how this person's teaching. Like I need to teach the class like that. And so I need to teach a really dynamic class that has to look like this and this, fit as many poses in as possible and be really cool and dynamic sequence in order for people to get the workout that they want. So I started teaching an appropriated form of yoga.
Yes.
I was terrified to chant because I thought people are going to think I'm really weird. And I didn't have the confidence to do that. Because firstly, I thought people would think I was weird, which is, again, an appropriated view, because that's what a lot of the reason why the British rule made, when they were ruling, they made yoga and Ayurveda illegal, is because they thought that the chanting and generally the practices were quite weird, in inverted commas, too spiritual, not conforming to societal norms and what they wanted to impose. But I got the feeling that people wouldn't, because I didn't see anyone else chanting in class. I didn't see any other teachers doing it. So then who am I to then come and start chanting? So that's one thing. But then the second thing is, I didn't think that they would want it. I didn't think it would make them like me. And I'm so glad that I'm not in that state now. And now I teach yoga the true way I want to teach it. And that doesn't mean chanting in every single class, but it does mean if I want to chant in a practice and teach them how to chant with me, we'll do that together. And the most stunning thing is hearing a group of people from all different backgrounds chanting in Sanskrit with you, that you have taught them, because they can do that. And then feeling the vibrations and all of them saying afterwards how emotional they felt and how connected they felt, because it has got incredible powers, the healing benefits of the Sanskrit. But certainly along the way, I excluded parts of my culture and I excluded parts of the practice of yoga in order to fit in and in order to be liked as a yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. And those mistakes that I don't regret, because I've learned from them. And I now try and empower other yoga teachers to not do those things and not make those mistakes that I've made. But I also don't regret it because I understand why I did it.
I'm so glad that you're aware of kind of that learning journey that you've been on. Do you think people around you are going through a similar journey of learning and trying?
I think it's difficult because, again, the way that it's presented is to honor and focus more on beautiful sequences, really cool transitions, flows. And the yoga poses are incredible and they've brought me so much to my life. And I really wouldn't be where I'm at without the physical part of the practice.
Yeah.
But then because everybody thinks that it's about that and everybody focuses on making a really complex, dynamic, ritualistic practice, we take no, well, I feel like people around me don't take as much of a focus on things like chanting or things like focusing on the breath. Or if we're doing a breath practice, you'll maybe do breathing for a minute or two. And then the rest of the class would be. So the ratio is massively split to, you know, 80-90% on movement.
Yeah.
And then maybe the remainder on a breath or a meditation or a chanting, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, yes, it's changing. And that's what I'm trying to push for, is a change and a more of a let's unearth all the different things that yoga brings to us as opposed to one element. But I don't think it's an obvious thing that people are doing.
Speaking of this community that we're in, how do you feel when you think about, you know, you've talked about certain elements of negativity possibly within the community and something that you're actively trying to not promote or kind of step away from. How do you feel when you think about the fact that this is a community that actually promotes positivity? In its nature, it's hypocritical that there is so much negativity within that community. Do you ever think about that? How does that make you feel? And what would you hope for, you know, what changes would you hope will happen in the future that will kind of eradicate this sort of weird dichotomy about this community?
It's interesting because sometimes we look at communities and we think the community has one voice, And that's wrong because we're not a monolith. And I think within that, people have different opinions within that community. And some, and so I'll give you an example. My sister used to tell me about the cultural appropriation of yoga years ago. Mm. And my response was, no, it's for everyone. Like, white people can practice yoga too.
Mm.
And that's a very fair comment back from me, but it was an ignorant comment because I didn't know the context and the history and what cultural appropriation even meant. Cultural appropriation does not mean excluding white people from the practice. It means that a dominant group has taken a practice which is an indigenous art, and mostly are the people who are shown to be practicing it and shown to be teaching it, and the people who are from that culture are often left behind. So it's not, fixing cultural appropriation is not to exclude white people, but I know that there are people in the South Asian community who do feel that way, and then there are people who don't, like myself. And so it's difficult because I'm speaking about trying to make it more open for my community and try to make my community feel more seen and feel more heard. But I'm also conscious that within that space, there will be what we will perceive as both positive and negative opinions of it.
Yeah,
I don't think you can get a whole community to be on the same page because, again, we're all humans that make that up, and we're not designed to be like that. But I do certainly wish that people saw yoga as something that they could bring into their life and that would really benefit from them, benefit them. I think one of the issues is that because we see it as such a practice that is quite exclusive and maybe not something we can be a part of, we're missing out on so many of the incredible rituals that we could be incorporating into our day, even if we don't have a yoga mat. And that's another thing I try and show people, little breathing techniques they can do when they've got an email and it stressed them out, or they can't sleep. What can you do to help you sleep better? Because that's it. It's the application of the practice and realizing it's a lifestyle as opposed to the way that we see it in the media and that kind of thing.
I'm not a yogi, but I take yoga classes. And in London, we know what it's like. We go to some of the bougie studios and, you know, wear our Lululemons, or I'll probably just wear Primark leggings and top. But as someone who takes yoga classes pretty occasionally, I mean, I'm sure there are people listening who probably do it quite regularly, people who might be considering going to their first class. As someone who is now very conscious of this appropriation that's happening and the efforts that are going into kind of removing that appropriation from the mainstream, how can I ensure that I am not part of the problem, that I'm part of the solution? What do I need to do? Like, practical steps.
I think there's two ways to look at this. So the first way is, how do you make those changes within your own life? And I think the biggest thing is taking yoga off the mat. So taking your learnings on the mat, whether you're doing a challenging pose and you fall over, how do you apply that then in your life? That, you know, you stumble upon something. There's so many mirrors, but then also vice versa, it taking your life onto the mat. So if you are trying to do Trikonasana and triangle pose, for example, and you wobble, how do you bring like a childlike playfulness to that and enjoy laughing at the wobble and embracing it and accepting it? And then again, back and forth, it's so weave your practice on the mat into your life and vice versa. So that's like on a smaller scale, what you can do for your life. And then on a bigger scale, things like looking at where you're learning about yoga. So who are you learning about yoga from? Do those people all look a particular way? Are they a particular size? Are they from a particular background? If they are, you're going to get a better view of the whole practice and you'll have a better education if you're learning about yoga from people from people who are from different backgrounds, and certainly from people who are from the culture who are teaching that kind of stuff. And also elevating those people. So showcasing them, going to their classes, going to their retreats, being aware of where you're learning about yoga, I think is a really important thing. Looking out for how people are pronouncing certain words, or not being afraid of asking your teacher who's just asked you to do a chant, what does that mean? Because I think otherwise you are just blindly chanting something and it completely takes the meaning away from it when we're just, you know, when we actually understand what these mantras mean and how powerful they are, you feel it so much more. You get the benefits so much more than if you're just randomly saying a word because you don't understand why. Like, what's the point in doing it? And so there's loads of things you can do, but I think starting with, where are you learning about yoga and how are you learning about yoga and how do you get a more diverse view of what the practice is, and then go from there.
What happens if I go to a class where none of that happened? Do I give them feedback? What do I do? Do I go to a different class?
It's challenging because I think with yoga, like with a lot of fitness or mindful or like anything where you're learning,
yeah,
the teacher is everything.
So true.
You know, if you went to a spin class and you hated the teacher, but you loved spinning, you wouldn't go back to that teacher, but you'd keep going back to spinning. And I think yoga's the same because it's a practice that you're going to and you're learning. Mm. And you have to find the right teacher. And not everyone's going to like the teacher, okay? Not everyone's going to like me as a teacher. Not everyone's going to like what I bring. And you have to find the teacher that works best for you. I had a love-hate relationship with yoga for about 5 years, on and off. And there were some teachers that I found so annoying and some teachers that I absolutely obsessed over.
Yeah.
So I think it's about finding the teacher that feels right for you. Mm. But I'd also be really careful because I don't want us to go around and police yoga teachers, because I also don't want yoga teachers to feel like they're being judged by people who are in their class.
Yeah.
So there's a fine line between going in and spending your entire class, because you're so conscious of not culturally appropriating, judging that yoga teacher, which is not a yogic thing to do, and then not really enjoying the practice for what it is and getting the benefits of the practice because you're so busy judging what the teacher's doing. So I think there's a line there that how do you, yes, it's great to give feedback in a way that makes the person feel like it's constructive. Mm. But then also I've noticed that I have to take my judgment out of it and go in and enjoy a practice because I need to go and do a practice with another teacher. I need to go to a gong bath. I need to go to whatever because I need to get the healing benefits from the practice without being judgmental, and knowing that also a lot of the appropriation is unintentional. And it doesn't mean that it excuses it, but it does mean that it's not that you don't have to feel as offended, but sometimes we get so like caught up in our anger and our frustration.
We do, yes.
But just like understanding that a lot of the time people don't realize. And yes, it's their responsibility. You should take accountability. You're a yoga teacher. You've decided to learn an ancient indigenous art. You have the responsibility to teach it correctly and to do your best to continually learn and educate yourself. Mm. But you go and enjoy that practice as well. I think giving feedback is a great idea and great option, and trialing yoga teachers, because intuitively and instinctually you'll know which teacher really fits in and works well for you and how you want to practice.
I am really glad you called that out, because I think after all the things I read, you know, on social media, there's so much out there about yoga's being appropriated, you know, and I think it becomes very easy to jump to the other extreme and go to a class where you're being taught by someone who is white, who looks a certain way, who might be physically thin, and think, oh, why am I learning from this person? And I've thought that, and I probably still have, like maybe last week I thought that, you know? And so I'm really glad that you've sort of educated me and kind of reminded me that it's not really about judgment.
I just don't want to create a world where we're slamming white yoga teachers because they're white.
Mm.
Because then how does that fix the issue?
That is probably the same issue.
It's the same issue. It's throwing hate at hate.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, there are white yoga teachers who are doing the work.
Yes.
And are making the best attempts to learn Sanskrit, not learn the whole language, but to learn certain words in Sanskrit that they can use in their practices to be respectful. And we shouldn't be blaming people if they're slim either. So, you know, I get it. It is a stereotype that yoga is often presented by white, slim, blonde women, but also I just think we need to be careful, because if we're talking about inclusion as well, how do those people feel included and supported to be able to make the changes to bring about a more inclusive world if they're being slammed for the color of their skin and for the way that they look?
Is that not the pedestal of privilege that they've sat on for so long? Because that is exactly what got them in the position they're in, because that's the aesthetic that people want to learn from and go to. And you go on social media and you follow I used to follow yoga pages that were just yoga poses, that nothing else, right? And it's just all these cool yoga poses. And I was just, oh, this is awesome. And they were all white, skinny women. And I was just like, is that what I need to aspire to? Because that's physically impossible. But, you know,
that's it.
I'll continue liking the posts.
That's it. You know, poses are so incredible and there's so many amazing benefits and they're really pretty to look at. And that's and that person's got, you know, worked towards a particular posture.
Yeah.
So it's not to detract away from that. But you did the right thing there by looking into, okay, well, how is this affecting me mentally? And is this making me think that I need to fit into that box and I need to be able to do this in order to do yoga? Because then that's a dangerous narrative and a false one as well that you don't want to have anymore.
Yeah.
So it's good to do that work. If you're not feeling affected by looking at those poses and you're like, no, I know that they look that way and I don't, and I just want to see them, that's fine. But doing the work to unpick what you're getting out of it is a great thing to do and a great practice to do. But I think when you talk about privilege, yeah, people who have that privilege, and aren't, we all have privileges, I have privilege as well, yeah. But white yoga teachers who are more likely statistically to do better and be more seen and work on bigger brand campaigns, and that's, research has shown that compared to people of color, have the platforms to be able to be true allies. Mm. And I was saying this the other day, I feel like when we make mistakes, like we were talking about earlier, you've got two routes to go down. You either go down the route of, I've made a mistake, oh my goodness, I'm so embarrassed. Oh no, everyone thinks I'm racist. I've been culturally appropriating, this is so bad. Let me just go and hide in a hole and just forget that whole thing happened and just keep doing what I'm doing.
Yes.
Or you can go down the route of being like, okay, I acknowledge I've made a mistake. I've appropriated at some point. That's okay, because so many of us have, because it's a systemic issue and it's the way that everything is set up structurally. What can I do to make change? How can I further educate myself? And then you go down the route, and that's how you be a true ally. And the ones who aren't true allies are the ones that stop because they're so conscious of getting it wrong. Well, guess what? You're going to have to get it wrong. You're going to have to get it wrong probably a few times. You're going to have to feel a bit embarrassed. But let's not shame those people who might already feel shamed, and let's not bring the shame on ourselves, and let's move forward to a place where we can all learn and grow. The people in privilege have the platforms and have the responsibility and the accountability to elevate people from the culture who are teaching the practice, and to elevate parts of the culture that have been eradicated because of what happened not even that long ago when the British ruled India, for context, but also to change the shape of an industry that is so exclusive. So yes, there's a whole privilege thing, and we don't see white yoga teachers doing as much as they should be doing. Absolutely agree.
So what you're saying and what I'm hearing is that anybody who is in this space, whether you're teaching, learning, we all have a responsibility when it comes to learning an ancient art form to make sure that we are calling things out if they're not quite right, and also teaching them the right way so that those messages are passed on the right way and not watered down to a version that's incorrect, right?
Yeah.
What if I go to yoga because I want to aspire to a certain aesthetic? Am I still appropriating if I do that?
No. I think that's a misunderstanding. Mm. A lot of people say yoga is more than asana. Like, yoga is more than asana. You can say that word in both of those ways. And it doesn't really make sense without giving any context to it. No, yoga is more than just the physical postures, but the physical postures are also a part of the practice and so it shouldn't be slammed. And it's absolutely fine to go to the practice and want to do crow pose. You know, that's such an incredible thing mentally, physically, spiritually, when you look at a posture and you think, I'll never be able to do that. And then you work towards it, and then maybe you are able to do it and it feels really comfortable and you are so proud of yourself, and that's great. I don't think that's appropriation at all. I think that's working through one of the elements of yoga. And I think through that comes the spiritual unlocking, through that comes the mental challenge that you've overcome, through that comes ways that you can apply that, what you've learned on the mat, off the mat. The yoga postures for me, like I said earlier, have absolutely saved me, completely transformed and changed my life. I love them. I still work towards certain postures. I still have a physical practice regularly. So I don't think that is what it's about at all. And I don't think people should feel bad if they only want to go to yoga to do the physical side. I think people who feel that way should be aware that there's much more to the practice than just that. And if they really love that, they're probably going to really like all of the other stuff, but also it'll come to you in time and you'll discover it when it's right for you to discover the wider practices and other elements of it.
You said that yoga did a lot for you when you were in a dark place. What did it do for you?
Oh, what did it do? It took me out of, I don't even know how. It was like there was this massive release that came from nowhere and I couldn't explain it. A lot of crying, a lot of tears, a lot of emotion, but not feeling sad, not feeling any particular emotion, just this big let go. Mm. And I still remember that moment of realization, there's something more to this practice than just the poses. Because all I was doing was dynamic yoga. All I was doing was vinyasa. I wasn't doing any meditation. I thought the breathing techniques were crap. I didn't believe in Shavasana, the last pose of the practice.
I love that pose. Waste of my time. Best pose.
I was like, I've got things to do, but I wouldn't dare leave because I'd feel really guilty. So I would never leave the class early. Some people do. Mm. But I would be lying there thinking, I've got to go home. I've got stuff to do. I'm that person. I've like got stuff on. Mm. I don't have time to meditate. All that. That was me. Mm. And then I needed to slow down and lots of bad stuff had happened. And that just saved me. And it was almost a month and a half, 2 months later, I was in India doing my teacher training because I wanted to learn more about the practice. I never aspired to be a teacher at all.
Okay.
And I've kind of fallen into that now, but saved me from disordered eating, saved me from a bad relationship. It saved me from myself, addictions, a lot. It saved me from a lot of stuff. Mm. It saved me from myself.
I love that. Tell me, Angie, what are the services that you offer now? I know that you've got a retreat, you've got your teaching that you do online, in person. What can people look out for when they kind of look into learning from you?
So there's loads of free content on my social media. So I'm constantly trying to share everything we talked about, how to make it more accessible for you, little tips and tricks if you feel stressed, if you need to sleep better and you're struggling, loads of little tips and tricks like that so that it's more accessible. I have some classes that are free on my YouTube. I always like to start with the free offerings because one of the issues in the yoga industry is that it is financially inaccessible to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So free offerings are there. But then I also have a membership platform called Unearthed.
Mm-hmm.
So Unearthed is really about unearthing ancient sacred rituals that you don't often see in westernized yoga classes and allowing yourself to bring them into your everyday life and really apply them. And that's got nearly 150 classes and they're on demand pre-recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So you sign in and you can practice anything from a meditation to a breathing technique to movement to philosophy class. And then there's a monthly members meet, which is online. So we have members across Europe, Australia, America, the UK, which is so lovely, such an amazing community. Mm-hmm. And then Unearthed is also the home to my retreats.
Mm-hmm.
So we run about 2 to 4 retreats a year.
In person?
In person retreats. And geez, nothing beats an in-person retreat. We just had one last Saturday, which was amazing. Explore your breath work. The next one's Explore Your Doshas, Yoga and Ayurveda retreat the first weekend of March, next weekend. And some things bubbling away for later in the year. And then private one-to-ones. Mm-hmm. I'll often have a bunch of students and I'll do ad hoc for private, for whoever wants to deepen their practice and learn in a one-to-one way, and they're in person as well.
You're such a force, Angie.
Aw, thank you.
I'm so glad to have shared this space with you. This has been such an enlightening conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot from just talking to you, just from an hour. Last question.
What do I have strong game in?
So an example is you could have strong game in, you know, educating others about the right ways to learn yoga. You could have strong game in being a plant mom or just anything.
Okay, I think certainly because I'm just hot off this retreat, being in that space, like creating a space for people who are complete strangers or even friends to come together and to open up and share. It's such a beautiful community atmosphere and people get so vulnerable and share things that they've never shared before because they feel safe to in that space. And sometimes you feel safer sharing things when you're in a space where there are strangers there and there's not someone you know and you've got that unbiased view and no one's there to judge. And creating those spaces, chanting with people, sharing yoga and sharing the roots of yoga and why I do what I do in person, in a group, it just feel like I've got strong game in. I feel like I'm on my absolute element when I'm doing that. I feel so comfortable and at home, but inspired by what I've learned, but also by what their reaction is to what they're learning and by their openness.
Mm.
And it reminds me how wonderful human beings can be in those spaces.
I love that. Thank you so, so much, Angie, for the work that you do, for the community. I know we're not a monolith, but your voice shines. And I really hope people kind of, you know, look at your journey and kind of get to learn from you more because you have so much to share and it truly is inspiring to just stand back and watch. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.